Now to get more of the story from Washington to Edwin Newman in Washington.
NBC News correspondent Nancy Dickerson is stationed in Lafayette Park across from the White House. Now to Nancy Dickerson.
It's only right that it rains in Washington today because the pall that has already settled over the city is so bad that nothing could be much worse. There are several lines of people across the street from the White House. They're holding umbrellas, and they, too, are drenched. They're not saying much. They're just holding a faithful vigil. There are really two centers of activity here as you stand and watch across the street from the White House. One is in President Johnson's office. His old office is the vice president in the executive office building. Now, the other one is in the White House, centering around the press secretary's office. And the activity goes back and forth between these two places. For the time being, President Johnson's office is deferring to the White House operation, and all official acknowledgments are coming from there. Mr. Johnson's office is a very, very busy place. The phones are ringing constantly. Secret Service are preventing most people from trying to get up there. Interesting thing about Mr. Johnson's telephone situation is that he always believed that even the Vice President of the United States should have his private personal telephone number listed in the telephone book. He has always adhered to that until last night when you called the Johnson home. An operator came in and said, all those calls are being referred to the White House. That number is National 81414. So for the first time since he's been in public office, President Johnson does not have his private phone listed in the telephone. Well, as is well known, the speech that President Kennedy was to deliver in Dallas yesterday concerned in part the TFX fighter plane. Just before he, Mr. Kennedy, left for Dallas, he had called Deputy Secretary of Defense Roswell Gilpatrick, who for a few days had been under fire by a somewhat hostile committee on Capitol Hill, concerning the TFX fighter plane. Mr. Kennedy called to congratulate Gilpatrick and said he had done well and said, don't be concerned about the criticism. After all, said Mr. Kennedy, I've been criticized a lot too. This is Nancy Dickerson of NBC News at Lafayette Park across the street from the White House in Washington.
And there's more word from Dallas about pro-communist Lee Harvey Oswald. He's arrogant, he's still in handcuffs, he's charged with the assassination of President Kennedy. Police said paraffin results on his hands were positive. They began questioning him again. This would indicate that he had fired a rifle. And Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry said Oswald's mood ever since he's been held has been very arrogant. He doesn't answer questions directly. He just says, that's ridiculous and that's silly. Chief Curry disclosed that a substantial amount of communist literature had been found in Oswald's rooms. He didn't specify what the literature was. Chief Curry said there were three witnesses to the shooting, and police were looking for a man who was reported to have picked Oswald up after the shooting. Curry said the Dallas police had not known Oswald was in town. It's customary, Curry said, for the FBI to notify local police when someone with a subversive background arrives in the area. Curry said Oswald has no lawyer. He understands that Oswald's mother is arranging for one. He said the Civil Liberties Union called and wanted to know if Oswald had been informed of his rights. Oswald is a Marxist, a Castro sympathizer. He calmly ate a breakfast of oatmeal, apricots, bread, and coffee. Paraffin results on Oswald's face were not available, although we had the report of the paraffin tests on his hands.
We go to Tom Perryman, station WFAA in Dallas.
We have information now from the Dallas Police Headquarters. One of our men reports a taxicab driver is now being questioned. The cab driver is alleged to have picked up Oswald, the accused slayer of President Kennedy, somewhere between the area where President Kennedy was shot and Oak Cliff, his home. The suspect, Oswald, is alleged to have taken a bus about halfway to his home in Oak Cliff, just across the river from the downtown Dallas area, where he took a cab from there to his home. He changed clothes there and went to the theater a short time later. Also from Dallas, the county judge, Lou Sterrett, is going to meet with the mayor, Earl Cavill, as soon as he can, possibly today or tomorrow. He is proposing the erection of a monument at the spot or near the spot where John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated in downtown Dallas. This is Tom Perryman at WFAA reporting for NBC News.
We also repeat a story received from the Defense Department earlier that Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, the man being held, once wrote to Texas Governor John Connally from Russia pleading that his undesirable discharge be reversed. The exact date of that letter, not known, but presumably it was while Connally was serving as President Kennedy's first Secretary of the Navy. All of which raises a new question whether the real target of the assault was Mr. Kennedy or Governor Connally. The two were riding with their wives in the presidential car when three shots rang out from that high-powered rifle from a high-level window overlooking the parade route. Mr. Connally was seriously injured, but is in satisfactory condition now. The president, of course, killed in that assault. And this just in from Dallas, Homicide Chief Captain Will Fritz said today, the assassination case against Lee Harvey Oswald is cinched. He said flatly, this is the man that killed President Kennedy. 24-year-old Lee Harvey Oswald being held in Dallas, Texas, for the assassination of the president. Now we try again for NBC's Robert McCormick in Washington.
Robert McCormick is taking a brief time off. This is Edwin Newman. What were you hoping to hear from us? Reaction, perhaps, to the news that the police officer in Dallas has said that the case against Oswald is cinched. That is a rather extraordinary thing to say at a time like this, and they must have certainly what evidence they consider conclusive against Oswald. I wonder what they have learned that they did not tell us about earlier. Have you heard anything on that?
Edwin, we're waiting for pickup now from Dallas on this later development. It does seem a little odd that the case is cinched this early.
They have perhaps made other tests. They had given us earlier, you remember, the results of the paraffin tests on the hands. They had not given us the result of the paraffin tests on the face. The tests on the hands had shown, they said, that Oswald had fired a rifle. The tests on the face presumably would have shown something more. I just want to say that we've had a further statement from the homicide chief in Dallas, Captain Will Fritz, the man who said the assassination case against Oswald was cinched, and who said this man killed President Kennedy. He also said, without going into the evidence, I can tell you this. This case is cinched. This man killed President Kennedy. We are convinced without any doubt he did the killing. There were no accomplices. So the homicide chief of the Dallas police has said that he is convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy and that he did it without help from anyone else. Now, Russ, earlier today, they had revealed that they had arrested a second man and were questioning him. Do you judge from this, then, that they have deduced that the second man was not connected with the crime?
Ed, allow me to interrupt you. We go right now to Tom Pettit with later developments on this story. Tom Pettit in Dallas.
Here's an example of the detail work going on. Captain Will Fritz of Homicide, who's heading the investigation, said they now have found out that Oswald left the book depository store from which the fatal bullets were fired at President Kennedy, that he's headed toward home, that he first took a bus, finding it too slow, switched to a cab. Then he went to his apartment, changed clothes, and went to the movie theater, where he later was apprehended after allegedly killing a Dallas police officer. They have located the cab driver. They have located the bus driver. These are two of the many witnesses who are being interrogated in building the case. Fritz, in his first appearance a few moments ago before newsmen, said it is a cinch case. This is Captain Fritz, head of the homicide squad, who's been conducting the investigation and interrogation. Captain, can you give us a resume of what you now know concerning the assassination of the president and Mr. Oswald's role in it?
There's only one thing that I can tell you without going into the evidence. Before first talking to the district attorney, I can tell you that this case is cinched. that this man killed the president?
Captain Fritz says it is a cinch case. District Attorney Wade was asked if he thinks it is a cinch case. He said that there is no such thing when there are 12 jurors involved, but it is, he says, a very good case against Lee Oswald. This is Tom Pettit, NBC News, reporting from Dallas Police Headquarters.
So you have just heard a pickup from Dallas with NBC's Tom Pettit, in which Homicide Chief Captain Will Fritz said today the assassination case against the president is cinched, that Lee Harvey Oswald is the man who killed the president. Again, we are quoting Homicide Chief Captain Will Fritz. Further developments from Washington now as we go back to Edwin Newman.
Russ, I wanted to put a question to you that I hoped you might be able to put to Tom Pettit. We have had the statements of the statement of the homicide chief in Dallas, Captain Fritz, that the case is a cinch. It has been cinched, and that Oswald is the man who killed President Kennedy, and that he did it alone. There were no accomplices. Has Tom Pettit, and I know what difficulties he's laboring under, been able to get any kind of indication from the people in charge of the case as to what the motivation of Oswald was? You suggested earlier this afternoon that it was at least conceivable that it was Governor Connally of Texas against whom Oswald was acting, if indeed he did act. Have you heard anything more about that?
We have not, Edwin. The basis for that speculation comes from Dallas, and it is based on the fact that Oswald had written a letter to Connally at an unspecified time, possibly while Connally was in serving as President Kennedy's Secretary of the Navy, in which Oswald is said to have objected strenuously to some ill deed he felt was done to him while he was in uniform. Apparently, he held the governor of Texas responsible for this, and there has been the suggestion that perhaps Connally was the target for the assassination bullet. Again, we must repeat that Oswald declares his innocence. He has not confessed to anything. He has declined to take a lie detector test. And while Homicide Chief Fritz has said the case is cinched, Oswald himself says he is innocent and the man has not yet gone to trial. So we simply pass along the latest development we get from Dallas. On the question of evidence, we have expect to hear from Pettit again momentarily, in which perhaps we can get further elaboration on that. I would assume, Edwin, that any additional evidence that may be held against Oswald will be held until the case comes to trial, that they certainly would not want to try the case on radio or television.
No, quite. They must hold the evidence, and I suppose there would be people in other countries whose judicial and legal systems are different from ours who would be shocked that even this statement has been made, that the police officer in charge of the case says, in effect, that Oswald is guilty. There are other countries that would not permit that to be said, would not permit us to say it on radio or television or in the newspapers.
It does seem unusual, and that but there is a possibility of a mistrial when such statements are made before the man goes before a jury.
I suppose we're getting perhaps too far ahead of the story, but I suppose Oswald's lawyer would almost automatically say it would be difficult, if not impossible, for him to get a fair trial in view of everything that has been said. Still, it is part of our legal system to see to it that he does get a fair trial, and as you have emphasized, and rightly, he is innocent until proved guilty.
We might mention in this connection, Edwin, allow me to interrupt, that
please,
with the nationwide publicity that has been given Oswald's arrest, a change of venue would seem to me, and I speak strictly from the viewpoint of a layman, a change of venue would be impossible. That the name Lee Harvey Oswald is known now from coast to coast. Is there such a thing as granting a impartial jury to this man anywhere in the country?
Well, I think we may say this, that in a case of the surpassing importance and somberness that this one will have, whoever might be tried in connection with such a crime, any jury would surely want and would give, want to give and would give the most sober sort of attention to the case before it. I think any jury would go into such a case with the most serious intentions and with the deepest responsibilities, and we should be able to count on that.
Edwin, allow me to interrupt this just a moment now. As we get further developments from abroad, we go to John Chancellor, NBC News, Berlin.
From our vantage point here in West Berlin, several important themes of communist reaction emerged today in connection with the death of the president. The point of most immediate importance to the people of the United States is that the Cold War apparently is not going to turn hot overnight because John F. Kennedy is gone and Lyndon Johnson has taken his place. There are several reasons for this. One is the great length to which Premier Khrushchev of the Soviet Union has gone to demonstrate publicly sorrow and shock over the death of the president. He was echoed in these demonstrations by the highest range of Soviet officials, including an influential and unofficial personality, Mrs. Khrushchev. Premier Khrushchev went beyond telegraphing his condolences today. Moscow let it be known that he returned to Moscow especially from an out-of-town trip so that he could call on the American ambassador for a personal demonstration of his feelings. On top of that, the Soviets are sending First Deputy Premier Anastas Mikoyan to President Kennedy's funeral. Mikoyan serves a double purpose. He is an old and canny Armenian negotiator who has always got along very well with Americans, and he is a man of exalted rank in the Soviet hierarchy. Moreover, the governmental leaders of the East Bloc satellites and their propaganda organizations have been relatively profuse in their messages of condolence and their reporting of the president's death. This applies to some very tough characters in the communist world, including Antonín Novotný of Czechoslovakia and Walter Ulrich of East Germany. Both have sent messages to Washington, and the leading newspaper in East Germany, Neues Deutschland, turned over a remarkably large portion of its front page today to the Kennedy story. In Moscow, the Russians have borrowed film of Mr. Kennedy from the American embassy vaults, and a special obituary program on the late president is now being prepared for Moscow television. President Johnson is described in Moscow Tonight as more conservative than Mr. Kennedy, but Moscow says that the policies of the Kennedy administration will be continued. Among other important things to recall, however, about the communist position is the fact, which must be exceedingly uncomfortable to communist propagandists, the fact that the man accused of murdering Mr. Kennedy has described himself as a Marxist and, according to one report, as a communist. Furthermore, the man has lived in the Soviet Union, reportedly sought Soviet citizenship, and married a Russian girl. Now, this poses a propaganda hurdle of gigantic magnitude for the communists, who were very quick off the mark to charge that the president had been killed by a right-wing American racist. So far, the communists have not tried to get over the hurdle, and no one in the Soviet Union, for example, has been told in any specific way of these details about Lee Harvey Oswald. But the voice of America is no longer jammed in Russia, and the people of that country are bound to get the word one way or another. So the Russians have a bad problem. They are beginning to work at a solution. Both the Soviet news agency TASS and Moscow Radio Home Service have called the case against Oswald a suspicious one, and they are jibing about the so-called police story of left-wing elements being involved, end quote. Finally, in their eulogies to the president, the universal communist line is that the world has lost a man who was working toward a relaxation of international tension. And, of course, so he was. But, by this tactic, the communists are making it possible to say, look, we got along with President Kennedy, and we said so when he died, but we can't get along with President Johnson. The Russians can say that if they want to. We don't know if they will or not. All we can say now is that on the basis of the evidence here tonight, the Cold War will not get a lot hotter tomorrow. John Chancellor, NBC News, Berlin.
Ellie Abel. This is Edwin Newman in the NBC newsroom in New York. Ellie Abel is here with a late report about the funeral plans, the burial plans for President Kennedy.
Up to now, there has been no decision announced on where
right.
the president is to be buried. It had been assumed he would be buried in the family plot at Brookline, Massachusetts, where he was born. However, we've just had a report that the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, his brother, was at Arlington National Cemetery this morning, escorted by Defense Secretary McNamara, looking at potential grave sites. So there is this possibility, still unconfirmed, that the president will be buried in the National Cemetery. He is, of course, an accredited and decorated hero from his service in the Navy during the war, and if buried there, would lie alongside so many of his comrades in arms of World War II.
If the president were buried in Arlington, Ellie, it would emphasize what so many people have said, that he did die on duty and in the course of duty.
It would indeed, and would remove the whole business from the private family context and put him in a national shrine.
I think nobody obviously would object to there being a private family service and burial, and if the president were buried in a family plot, nobody would object, but I think there is a great feeling that the president belongs to the nation.
I'm sure of that, and I'm sure also the decision will be made primarily by Mrs. Kennedy and his brothers.
If he were buried in Arlington, is there now a suitable plot that exists? Would something special have to be set up?
Well, there are plots available for war veterans, and he, of course, qualified. As I said earlier, all we know for certain is that the Attorney General and the Secretary of Defense were at Arlington today and looked at a number of sites, presumably some of the choicer ones.
Ellie, I wish you would join in. I think John Chancellor is on the circuit in Berlin and has had some very interesting things to say about the way in which the communists are reacting, and particularly the Russians are reacting to the death of President Kennedy. John, you said the Soviet government was sending Anastas Mikoyan to represent it at the funeral of President Kennedy. The last time Mikoyan was here was over the Cuba affair. He had to pick up the pieces for Khrushchev after that one.
And was sent to Cuba, by the way, to persuade Castro.
Also went to Cuba to pick up the pieces with Castro.
Well, Edwin, I would, if you'll allow me, submit the idea that Anastas Mikoyan, although he may have come here on a difficult errand in connection with the Cuban crisis, has always got along reasonably well with Americans. I think that...
Oh, yes, I think he was sent here at the time of the Cuban crisis because he got along well with Americans. I was only remarking that. He obviously has such a record and such a reputation.
And also, he's a man of considerable rank in the Soviet Union.
I was struck by something you were saying before, John. We on this side, many people on this side, have been worried about the possibility that the Cold War would get hot because of what had happened. And your view and the view of most people is that that is unlikely. It will not get appreciably hotter. But from what you said, I have the impression that the Russians are somewhat worried also, and possibly more worried than we are. Is that a fair statement?
Worried about the of the change in administration?
Yes, because the unknown, after all, is on this side, if it is unknown, rather than on their side.
Well, I have no way of knowing what is in Mr. Khrushchev's mind, but it seems to me that they had been able to work out some reasonable agreements with him. They were small, but they were leading in a particular direction. And now, of course, they have quite another quantity to deal with, another human being with a different political chemistry. And I think, however, the general view here, Edwin, is that the technicians and some of the not absolutely top-level policymakers will now take over for a while. This would indeed have happened in the Soviet Union had Khrushchev died suddenly, that the apparatus or establishment takes over for a while because it's very technical and complicated to be a single leader, as Kennedy was, in a sense, and as Khrushchev. And I think Ellie would agree that the role of Dean Rusk in the course of American policy and foreign affairs has been amplified and magnified by this.
Would you agree, Ellie, that Secretary of State Rusk's role is much larger now, especially early in the Johnson administration?
Yes, I would have to agree. President Johnson has sat in over the past 3 years on a great many important policy discussions, but he has not made the kinds of decisions that a president does make. There's no way of training for that kind of job in advance. My guess is that he will lean rather heavily on Secretary of State Rusk and Defense Secretary McNamara and others who over the past 3 years have shared the President Kennedy's burden in making these decisions.
And, Edwin, if I can come in on what Ellie said, for the reason that the known quantities of McNamara and Rusk and a number of other people, that if they have a heavier role in this, they are rather well known and are not likely to go off in a dangerous course from a Soviet or a communist point of view, and therefore I don't think there is any high-level apprehension in Moscow tonight.
John Chancellor, allow me to interrupt just a moment here. This is Russ Ward in New York. I was intrigued by your statement of a moment ago that the communist bloc nations now are allowing VOA broadcasts to get in unjammed. What significance do you attribute to that?
Well, it's part of the general easing of tensions in teeny-weeny little steps, if you want to use an untechnical phrase, that we have achieved over the past year or so with the Soviet Union. The foreign broadcasts, I believe the Russian-language broadcasts are no longer jammed in the Soviet Union, and when the Voice of America broadcasts the details on the man who's accused of murdering the president, they do so much as we do in the United States. We say what we know about him, and therefore I believe that's getting through. This, of course, means that the Russians no longer live in a hermetically sealed society, that they can get these programs if they want to go to a little trouble to get them, and it means that the Russians are going to have to work out a rationale. They came out very quickly. With the minute they learned the pigmentation of that killer in Dallas, Moscow began talking about right-wing elements, and so I might point out that a lot of people in Britain and Germany and France and everywhere else, and editorial writers and newspapers, communist and non-communist, began digging out the files on what they'd done to Adlai Stevenson in Dallas, and this about Dallas and the rest about Dallas. The Soviet propaganda apparatus, working with these materials, very early on in the game, implied fully in their statements and coverage of this that the deed had been done by somebody of the extreme right who was angry with Kennedy for his position on the color problem in the United States. Now they've got to find a way of taking that back and acknowledging somehow to their own people the fact that this man once lived in the Soviet Union, requested Soviet citizenship, married a Russian girl.
John, State Department authorities said earlier today, and perhaps Ellie Abel will have more on this, said they have no evidence indicating the involvement of the Soviet Union or any other foreign power in the assassination of the president. I wonder if this news has been consumed by the Russian people. Has this been made available in the Russian broadcasts?
I don't know. I would venture to say not in the order of these things. That might be used later by Moscow radio or home service Russian radio, but at this point I don't believe, although I don't have the transcript of their broadcast, that it so far has been used.
Edwin Newman, do you have anything further now from Washington?
I have a question for John. I hope he's still there. John, have you heard anything about communist Chinese reaction to this?
Yes, and I'm trying to think, Ed. The Chinese...
They have been quite restrained, I believe.
They have been extremely restrained, and they are not dealing with the Kennedy story. They are dealing with the Kennedy story, but they are playing it far down in their newscasts, I believe, and are giving it an unimportant position in their newspapers. The importance of that, it seems to me, is the fact that the entire tier of communist states and the Soviet Union itself, which we observe from Berlin, have given a very prominent display to the Kennedy story, and the Chinese are just not doing so.
The view of the Chinese, then, one might judge, is that this really doesn't matter to them. It's not going to make any significant difference to them, and I suppose they would extend from that that it should not make any significant difference to any other communist countries, Russia included.
Well, I think from a dogmatic point of view, that's absolutely true, that the Americans are depicted as the international gendarmes, no matter who happens to be at the head of the nation, and that capitalism is a particular kind of evil, no matter how it is clothed or who it heads it. So I would say in that sense, yes. I wonder if I might put in a question here to you or to Ellie or to Russ, if it isn't a little bit of showing off in a way of taking a story about the death of an American president, which is something that's pretty important to an awful lot of people, including an awful lot of Chinese, and being deliberately insulting about it in a particular way by playing such an important story in such a small way. Are there any thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought on it would be what I have already said, which is that it would be part of the Chinese ideological argument that, in fact, the identity of the president of the United States doesn't really matter to them, that there are, in the first place, larger forces at work, and in the second place, that no possible change that could come about in the United States in personalities would make that would have that great an effect on policy. I don't think that the Chinese can comfortably argue that a mere change in personality can eliminate what they would have to say are fundamental differences between them and us. And I think they would be obliged to say that the United States is trying to destroy China. That is what they do say. I think, therefore, it is ideologically, communistically, Marxist, Leninistically impossible for them to concede that it makes any difference. That is an awful thing to say, but I think it's true. Ellie, you want to say something?
Well, I think the Chinese, as at present the orthodox party in the communist dispute, have to take the position that the United States is an imperialist power whose policies are determined by monopoly capitalists, as they call them, in this country. And they have argued for a very long time that the personality and leanings of the president are quite irrelevant, that imperialists behave like imperialists, no matter who happens to be sitting in the White House. The interesting thing is that the Russians, on the other hand, have been playing this rather differently. Mr. Khrushchev, who'd been missing for several days, none reported at least, appeared this morning at Spasso House wearing a black suit, signed the book of condolences that Ambassador Kohler had set up at the door, talked privately with Kohler, sent messages to the new president and to the widow Kennedy, expressing his sorrow and that of the peoples of the Soviet Union over the death of a man whom he described as having worked so hard for peace. I think this is an indication in a rather human vein at the moment, because of the tragedy of the president's death, of the rather different way these are able to behave.
And it is, in a way, I suppose, another bone of contention between them, that the Chinese might well feel that the way in which the Russians are conducting themselves is not a way for a communist power to conduct itself.
Are we holding a lot of people up, or could I ask a question?
Russ Ward, I think you're in command. Are we holding other people up?
We're holding no one up, and the microphone is yours, John.
Well, I'd like to ask all of you what reaction you had, and I haven't been able to hear the coverage, so perhaps you've gone through this, but the original reaction you had when you learned of the president's death, did you feel that suddenly that the Russians might do something, that the Russians might take advantage of the fact that he'd just been killed to do some awful and not really well-defined thing to us? Was there any feeling like that in the United States?
Russ, why don't you answer
I don't think so, John. I think this country has a history of bipartisan support in most foreign policy, certainly in our dealings with the Soviet Union. I think the death of the president was more a personal thing, not one that could be translated in terms of what do we do now in Berlin, or what do we do now about Formosa, or what do we do about the Soviet Union or Cuba. I think that by and large, everyone in official Washington and everyone else is dedicated to the freedom of Berlin, is dedicated to the freedom of this country and its fight against international communism, I don't think for a minute that there were thoughts of a sudden collapse of our foreign policy. Ellie, you probably have more to say on that than any of us.
Russ, Ellie's had to go, answer a call. He has a number of people on the line from whom he's getting information. I think the answer to John's question would be that at the time President Kennedy was killed, I do not believe that anybody thought that any foreign power had anything to do with it. At least I don't know of anybody who thought that. I didn't hear it suggested. I think a great many people had the same reaction, that the same feeling that the Russians so apparently unwisely did, that it was something that came from perhaps the extreme right, somebody crazed, but on the extreme right. That was a reading that, so far at least, appears to have been false. But I think since everybody was stunned and astonished and at first unbelieving, that it didn't occur to anyone that this might be any sort of international plot, or that the Russians would try to take advantage of it, because that would be too transparent a thing and too dangerous a thing to do. Anybody who tried to take advantage of it might well be associated in the public mind with the idea that they were responsible for it.
Edwin and John, too, the immediate reaction that I heard in Washington was one that possibly it was a person who was irate over President Kennedy's civil rights program. As it turns out, if what we hear from Dallas is true, this seemed to have a negligible role in what took place, if any role at all.
I'd like to rephrase my question, if I may. I didn't mean to imply when I said it, prompting these interesting and significant answers of yours, that I had believed that the Soviet Union had any, is it, causal relationship with the fact, with the shooting. But I was interested in the attitude of the American people. We tend, under our system, more and more nuclear weapons make us do this, I believe, to think of the president as a man who has a button. And if he presses that button, all kinds of things go off, and we're in a war. And that Khrushchev has a button. And when one of the two men in the world who control these enormous arsenals of nuclear weapons dies, and there is this moment of uncertainty that follows his death about, excuse me for phrasing it this way, but who's got the button? Did any of these thoughts go through the minds of people you knew, or your own minds? And I'm not talking now vis-a-vis the Russians or any plot or any foreign policy thing. You see what I'm getting at, Edwin?
I see what you're getting at, John, and I do not know of anybody to whom that idea occurred, with the exception of the Germans, apparently, who took certain precautionary measures and put their armed forces, so we understand from Wells, hanging on a very high alert called Alert 1. That is, I suppose, a reasonable enough precaution to take when you are that close and when you don't know what is happening. But I am not aware of anybody who thought that the Russians would try to exploit this. What I was trying to say before was that I think the danger of trying to exploit it would have been overwhelming. I think anybody who tried to exploit it might have been accused of being responsible for it. In any case, I don't think anybody could try to exploit it without running the gravest sort of risks. Of course, we did have Pearl Harbor. People don't always stop to tell you what they intend to do to you. But the danger of the scope of the size of the reaction now is so much greater and so much more lethal that it is hard to see anybody doing anything of a risky nature.
Well, then what we're really saying, I think, is that the securities and the dangers of the world situation are really so gigantic now that the death of one man, no matter how much we may miss him, are not really going to change that balance.
They may not change it immediately, John. It is possible that they will change it in a variety of subtle ways later on because of shifting weights, shifting authorities within the, within the Western Alliance. That if, for example, President Johnson should be a less effective leader than President Kennedy has been, if American influence in the alliance should wane, if issues should arise between our allies and ourselves that cannot be resolved and that make tempers shorter on both sides, all of those things could certainly affect the future, and so the passing of President Kennedy could certainly affect the future, I think. There was also something you mentioned before, that now the personal chemistry between Mr. Johnson and Khrushchev comes into the picture.
Well,
what I was going to say was that President Kennedy and Mr. Khrushchev knew each other quite well and apparently understood each other reasonably well. At least they have for the last year.
Well, they were in, to use again a non-technical term, they were pen pals. they had met, as I recall, only once at Vienna. Isn't that right?
Yes, at Vienna.
And in a very strained meeting, which I remember being there, and how we all recall how shocked and how sober the president was when he came away from that meeting. And actually, I think you're quite right in what you say, however, is that they had learned one another in a very interesting and in a kind of an intimate way. And the chemistry is going to have to be reworked again. Isn't that what you mean?
Yes, and we don't know what will come out of that. You were at Vienna, so was I, and as you say, the president was shaken and shocked and must have been greatly saddened, but also made quite determined by what he learned there. But I think if we look back on that, we will believe that that was Khrushchev trying to take Mr. Kennedy's measure. We may now have to wait, if Khrushchev is so inclined, for him to take Mr. Johnson's measure. And until he does, we may not be able to know how well they're going to get along. And how well they get along will have a great deal to do with the future of all of us.
I agree absolutely, and would only add to that that when I was talking about the death of one man not changing the balances of the world, I meant that, of course, quite in the present.
Yes.
John, before we lose you here, speaking of this personal chemistry that you and Edwin were talking about a minute ago, how would you define the chemistry between Lyndon Johnson and the people of West Berlin? Do they feel they have as strong a friend and Lyndon Johnson as they had in John F. Kennedy?
Well, the answer is, it really has to be a two-part answer. The first is no. Their manifestation of affection for Kennedy has been phenomenal. Last night at 1 in the morning, we had 40,000 people in a torchlight ceremony here in front of the City Hall, and I defy you to find any city in the world last night, including Washington, D.C. or Boston, where 40,000 people gathered together in mute adoration of a man. So I think that no one could take his place in their hearts in this emotional week or weekend. Now, I remember Lyndon Johnson when he was sent here after the wall went up in Berlin, and he was here on the 19th of August, 1961, as a demonstration of American support. Then, at that point, he was, I believe, very effective with the people of West Berlin. We had been up to see the wall, the caravan turned and came back toward the center of Berlin, and Lyndon Johnson, then the vice president, was riding in a closed car. The people of Berlin, in that terribly emotional week when the wall went up, were lining the streets of Berlin, West Berlin, and he felt that, and the kind of again, if we're talking about chemistry, overcame him, and also his very natural inclination to politic wherever he is. He asked his driver to stop the car, and he got out, and of course there was a mob scene, and he walked for three or four blocks down the street shaking hands with the people of West Berlin. I've had a number of people here in this city speak to me about that incident. They couldn't all have been there, but they saw it on television and read about it in their newspapers, and I would say that President Johnson has in a reservoir of affection here in the people of Berlin that is something quite valuable for him, and it was based mainly on that one trip. Of course, he's known Willy Brandt for years, but the main thing was that one trip after the wall.
John, thank you for that appraisal. Edwin, do you have anything else to add from Washington?
Not at this moment, Russ.
We'll be coming back to both of you later in the day. I might bring you right now this New York Times report from Dallas, Texas. Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of President Kennedy, made an informal plea today to communicate with an unidentified individual in New York City, this according to the New York Times. As he was being led handcuffed from a renewed police interrogation this morning, the 24-year-old warehouse worker paused in front of television cameras in a police department corridor and said, "I want to talk to Mr. and then there's a blank in New York City." The name he mentioned sounded something like Aft or Apt, but before he could be clarified, Oswald was pushed on by detectives.
Russ Ward.
Yes.
This is Newman in Washington. I saw that story, and the story I saw spelled the name of the lawyer. I take it it was a lawyer. APT. In fact, there is a well-known lawyer in New York who spells his name ABT, and who has been the attorney in many cases involving left-wing people. I don't want to go beyond that. My memory doesn't entirely hold up on this, but it is. I'm almost sure the man he had in mind spelled his name ABT and is an extremely well-known lawyer, has been here in Washington on a number of cases, and I think that must be the man he had in mind. I believe his first name is John.
That's very interesting. It would seem to further indicate the allegiance that Lee Harvey Oswald had with communist causes.
The following is a note for stations. For those local stations that might have some local news or public service announcements of local importance, we will provide stations with approximately 4 minutes for this purpose, at 5 minutes before the hour and half hour. The network will, however, continue coverage during this period. The following is the cutaway cue. You're listening to NBC's continuous coverage of the events surrounding the death of the late President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Bob, do I hear behind you that the President is coming?
He is just walking across, yes. We are looking out the press room window now. He is coming across West Executive Avenue from the Executive Office Building. He is entering the White House from the... through the west door on the street level. The fish room is prepared now. The cameras are getting set. Our microphones are in order, and we would imagine that it just will take him now a matter of a minute or even less before he comes up from West Executive Avenue, that entrance there, and then into the fish room. Hoping to see more now. He is in the White House now. Bryson Rasch is standing next to me with a better view. We don't know anything more about the meeting with former President Truman as yet. We're assuming for the moment that it will be held immediately after the proclamation is read. Bryson?
I should assume so. It's impossible to identify anyone as they walk across the street. There's a great group of men coming across under umbrellas with raincoats on in this driving rain, and it's darkness settling over the city, and it's just impossible to identify anyone. Anyone could meet with the president at the moment. But he's now in the White House, coming up in the elevator. He'll be in the fish room in a matter of moments.
The rain has not only made us awfully wet here, we're soaked through, but it's made identification extremely difficult, as Bryson has pointed out. At the North Portico, most of the persons there have their windows rolled up. The inside is steaming. And now we're here. The president is now entering the fish room of the White House. He is walking to the battery of microphones. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
To the people of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 35th President of the United States, has been taken from us by an act which outrages decent men everywhere. He upheld the faith of our fathers, which is freedom for all men. He broadened the frontiers of that faith, and he backed it with the energy and the courage which are the mark of the nation that he led. A man of wisdom, strength, and peace, he molded and moved the power of our nation in the service of a world of growing liberty and order. All who love freedom will mourn his death. As he did not shrink from his responsibilities, but welcomed them, so he would Have us not shrink from carrying on his work beyond this hour of national tragedy. He said it himself. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. Now, therefore, I, Lyndon B. Johnson, President of the United States of America, do appoint Monday next, November 25, the day of the funeral service of President Kennedy, to be a national day of mourning throughout the United States. I earnestly recommend the people to assemble on that day in their respective places of divine worship, there to bow down in submission to the will of Almighty God, and to pay their homage of love and reverence to the memory of a great and good man. I invite the people of the world who share our grief to join us in this day of mourning and rededication. In witness whereof, I have hereunto set my hand and caused the seal of the United States of America to be affixed. Done at the city of Washington, this the 23rd day of November, in the year of our Lord, 1963, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 188th.
That was the President of the United States, Lyndon B. Johnson, reading a proclamation issued earlier this afternoon, proclaiming Monday, November 25th, as a day of mourning for President Kennedy. As President Johnson read the proclamation, when he said, "We offer reverence to the memory of a great and good man," he was filled with emotion. We thought for a moment that he might break down and cry, or in some way show his emotions and manifest themselves in a more obvious way. Tears seemed to come to his eyes at that moment when he referred to a great and good man. He paused and looked straight ahead when he said it. He referred to the president as a man of wisdom, strength, and peace. That's it from the White House, Ed Newman.
We've just heard here in the NBC newsroom in Washington that President Johnson plans to address a joint session of Congress next week. That information comes from a top leader in the administration. He said it is still not certain whether Mr. Johnson will make his first congressional appearance as president on Wednesday or Friday, but it probably will be on Wednesday. He said he did not expect it to be a program speech or a partisan speech. That is to say, it will not deal with legislative matters. He thought the president would make a plea for national unity. Now back to Jim Hurlbut in New York.
And Ed Newman will have a report from Hyannisport in just a moment.
The NBC Radio Network has canceled all regularly scheduled programs to bring you this continuous coverage of the events surrounding the death of the late President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. We will be on the air with this continuous coverage until 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight.